Welcome to About Progress, a podcast devoted to ordinary people who are striving to improve themselves, overcome obstacles, and make something special of their lives, all while maintaining a healthy balance. In short, people who know life is about progress, not perfection. Hi everyone, I'm so glad you're here and hope you keep coming back each Wednesday. If you are a fan of this episode, please take a screenshot and share it, whether that's online or not. If it is on social media, tag me so that I can interact with you. I love doing that. You'll find me on Instagram and Facebook at About Progress, and you can tag me with that handle. And you can also email me at packerprogress@gmail.com to nominate someone to be on the show. Today's guest is Paul Cardall. This interview will change your life. I do not say that lightly. Paul Cardall is America's pianist, a Billboard-topping artist with several number one albums, and his music has been streamed 1.5 billion times online all over the world. He is the founder of a very successful record label, Stone Angel Music, and he does so much for charity too. And yet I truly don't know if I've ever heard from someone more humble about his achievements and more intent about what he believes his mission is on earth and through his music. Paul was born with half of a heart and miraculously lived. In 2009, he received a heart transplant. And it was after this miracle that Paul was faced with crushing depression, guilt, and the dissolution of his marriage and more. Paul speaks about all of this, including how and why he started playing the piano in his late teens, what the process is like for him to create, and what he hopes his music does for others, and how our trials in life act as the catalyst to real growth and learning, which is something he knows firsthand. A quick note before I turn the time over to Paul. We actually recorded this back in July, and his interview was set to air in September. But when I realized his amazing interview with Brianna from the Life Beats Project was airing a week before mine, I asked Paul if we could delay. I wanted my audience to hear him with fresh ears in case there is some crossover. Brianna's interview with Paul and his wife Tina is excellent, and I highly recommend that you listen to it, and I've linked to it in the show notes for you. It's also about very different things than what Paul and I spoke about. So if you are a fan of Brianna like me, just know that there is new stuff in store for you today. And I'm so thrilled that you get to hear from Paul again and in a different way. I did take a page from Brianna's book here and have blended in one song of Paul's, Gracie's Theme, into two parts of the interview because it was a brilliant move on her part. You just have to hear Paul's music to really get a sense of the power this man holds and the lessons he can teach us all. So without further ado, I would love to give the rest of the time to my interview with Paul Cardall. Hi, I'm here with Paul Cardall. Hi, Paul.
How are you?
I'm so great. Really thrilled to have you on. And my husband is even more thrilled, as I told you. So I'm just so grateful you take the time and it's late on your end. And I would love if you could start by telling our listeners a little more about you.
Sure. I was born and raised in Salt Lake City. Most people know me as a pianist. I've been a recording artist for the past 20 years, and I own a record label called Stone Angel Music. And let's see, what else could I say? I'm working on my 21st or 22nd studio album right now, and wow, just loving life.
So, and you live in Nashville.
So I actually live in Salt Lake City, but I'm in Nashville so much that it's almost like I live here, but my home is in Utah.
Okay, so are you there right now to work on your label or doing music stuff?
So I came to Nashville this is kind of an interesting story. My wife and I were in New Orleans last Thanksgiving, because I was keynoting a conference, a medical conference of cardiologists. My background, I was born with a congenital heart defect, which is, the number one cause of infant-related deaths, but fortunately, I survived, and I had a heart transplant 7 years ago. So I get asked to speak at these medical conventions, and it's almost like, hey, Lazarus is alive, so let's listen to what Lazarus has to say. And so I was speaking at this event, and we decided to take a road trip because my wife Tina, her family is in Cleveland. We wanted to drive from New Orleans up through Tennessee and Kentucky and go all the way to Cleveland. And we did this. We stopped in Memphis. And as a musician, like, this whole thing was like, this was a great, great tour. Yeah. Just driving with my wife. And then we came to Nashville. And in Nashville, you know, I've been in the music business for 20 years, and yet I've never been in Nashville. I've had albums debut number one on Billboard charts, but I don't know anybody in Nashville. It's a totally different world to me. I'm in classical and the classical crossover music, Christian music. And so coming to Nashville was just new. And so we just came here just out of interest and curiosity. I just had this overwhelming feeling like, you got to come to Nashville.
Oh, wow.
So when I get, you know, a strong, strong impression like that, I try to act on it, because an impression for me either is a message from God, or it's myself, or vice versa. It doesn't matter. Just, you've got to act on an impression where you have something so strongly told to you. So I said to her, are you feeling this? And she said, yeah, I'm totally feeling this. We should come back to Nashville. So we went to, you know, for Thanksgiving for her parents, or in Cleveland. It's our mom and dad, and went back to Utah, and then we basically rock and rolled it. We grabbed two suitcases, and 4 months later, just packed our home up for 3 months and came to Nashville in March. We were here March, April, May, went back home, and now we're back here. But in coming here, that's where everything just started to open up for me. And so where we're at now is I am working with a producer who is very well respected. His name is Jim Daneker. He has been the musical director for Michael W. Smith, who's a mega Christian star, for the past 20 years. And Jim and I connected really well. And so he's working with me to produce my Christmas album for next year. But long story short, I acted on a prompting. It was totally crazy to go and just take off and do it, but we were in a position to do it. And big things are evolving and happening because we were willing to act.
Well, I have a lot more I'd like to talk to you about your music, but first I want to go back to, you talked about being born with that congenital heart defect, and since you had that transplant 7 years ago, it seems like, you know, the majority of your life, you had to have dealt with issues related to this condition. So how has that condition affected your life?
I think it's a huge impact on my life, but I didn't really realize how big of an impact it was until later in my life, because I was born with defect. I had surgery as an infant, but I had a unique situation because I was only born with half a heart, and so the doctors didn't expect me to live at all. The surgeon miraculously figured out what to do and created some technique that allowed me to live, but my parents really did not expect me to live very long. They always had hope, and they're trusting God, and, you know, you make the best of the situation. And but I was raised constantly in the hospital, being told and overhearing conversations of like, this, you know, it's amazing he's alive. Let's just keep our eye on him because we don't know how long he's got.
Wow.
So I was raised not knowing.
And do you think that was, I mean, obviously, as a parent now, I mean, thinking about your own children, do you think it was the right
the right way to go with your parents, you know, just letting you continue to live without knowing, like, oh, you know, this, you might not have that long to live, son. or do you think it was, I don't know, if it still seeped in eventually, I guess.
My parents, we just celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary.
Wow, they're incredible.
So I got great parents. Yeah. It's really fortunate. Not everybody in the world has the support that I was born into. And so I'm constantly aware of the challenges people experience because they don't have the support. I was given parents who are optimistic, who asked lots of questions. My dad was a journalist. He asked lots of questions, and they made sure they did everything within their power and their faith and prayers to keep me alive. You know, I've got 8 other siblings. My mom had a lot of children. We were the typical station wagon family in suburbia, Salt Lake City. Mm-hmm. Typical Mormon family. And my parents were just there constantly for each one of us. Now my siblings might say, okay, well, they were there more for Paul, but that's obvious because in some scenarios I was in the hospital and they weren't.
Yeah.
But you know, they made the most of it, and technology and surgery techniques just kind of were there and available as I got older and older. So when I was 13 and needed surgery, and 14 when I had reconstructive open heart surgery.
At 14, which, you did?
Yeah, 13, 14, they opened me up and operated on me. And
how scary.
I just thought it was just part of life. I mean, it was what I did.
I see.
I didn't know anything else.
So when did it eventually become this need to have a transplant?
So it was 22 years after my surgery as a 14-year-old. Is when I had the severe heart failure, and that's when my health declined immediately. I couldn't do any music. I couldn't work. I was in an overstuffed chair in my home. I was wearing oxygen, 3 liters of oxygen. There was a huge tank, a 50-foot cord that went to me. If my daughter wanted to find me, she'd go find that cord and just follow it, and I'd be at the other end. And if she was upset at me, she would kink the hose.
Oh, no.
Because she thought, you know, that would get me to pay some attention. But it was a challenging time, and a dark time. Mm-hmm. It was a sacred time because, and the only way I can explain it to people is if, you know, because when I went in to the doctor and he told me pretty much you need a heart transplant, he also told me how long it would take. And I asked him how long it would take, how long I had if I didn't get one. He told me, if you don't get a heart and we don't find one for you, you probably only got about a year, maybe a year and a half. I said, well, how long is it going to take? And he said, there's a huge waiting list. A lot of people need organs, and there's not enough people registered to be organ donors. So you could be waiting up to a year. So I put that together. I'm like, wait a second, that's a catch-22. You've just put me in a pickle. And so what do I do? And he's like, don't worry about it. We're going to do the best we can. My team was amazing, and all I could do is wait, you know, wait for that call. But the only way I could describe it is if I gave you a envelope and told you that inside the envelope is the expiration date to your birth certificate, you know, if would you want to open up the envelope? Would you want to look and see a date of when your time on this earth is over? Because that's what people that are given a diagnosis like me, or, you know, cancer or other illnesses, they're told you've only got this much time. And so you have to ask yourself a lot of questions. And I thought I had everything figured out at the time, because I had lived a very, very beautiful life. Everything I ever wanted, everything I dreamed of, was given to me. And the challenges really came after the miracle, after I survived and received the heart.
Well, you know, the difference, though, with someone being told this is when you are going to die versus having an illness that is shortening your life is you don't have the luxury of spending that time the way you'd like to if you were healthy. You know, like maybe you won't be able to, even if you know, oh, I've got this much time, you don't have the luxury to like go travel if that's something that you desperately wanted to do. Like maybe you're not in the physical state to be able to do that, or maybe I just want to produce so much music. And it seems like for you, that was even inhibited during that time. And I like that you said it was both a dark and a sacred time. But how can you say that? How was it both a dark and sacred time?
Well, the darkness comes from the mystery. You know, we allow ourselves to ask, you know, we ask so many questions that we don't know the answers to, because there's no physical evidence or proof of some afterlife. And so you begin asking yourself, you know, is this all there is? Is this it? You know, and then at the same time, I had a child, and I knew that this is the only experience she might have of her father is he's sick. So how am I going to behave and react? And I was determined, to survive and live the remainder of whatever time I had left as an optimist. I started my own blog as a way of journaling, because when you journal, which is a thing that a therapist will tell you to do if you're struggling, write down your thoughts, because processing it allows you to process what you're thinking and feeling onto paper, and then you're able to read it and mark it and check grammar. It helps you internalize what you're experiencing. So I began to journal, but because I had an audience of people wondering why I wasn't out doing shows, or they were concerned about me, they heard I was sick. So it was a way to educate my audience, but mostly I wrote it for my daughter at the time, so she would know how I felt about life. And it was as though, as when I would write, God was teaching me and putting thoughts into my heart what really mattered in life. And so leading up to getting the heart, when I was so sick and so vulnerable, you know, you mentioned a bucket list. The bucket list for me was what I was going to do once I got my heart.
Oh, I see.
Huh. It wasn't, but up until I had to earn the right to go out and do everything that Tim McGraw talks about in the, you know, his Live Like You're Dying song, Live Like You're Living. It's a sacred time because you're vulnerable. You're so vulnerable, and you can get angry. But there's no point in getting angry, because you have to hope that there is something else. And the more you hope that there is something else, there's this faith that starts to build in you, and this belief that there is. And I was so secure in my Christian faith when I was most vulnerable. I had no doubt of the reality of an afterlife. It was just something that was constantly like this. It's as though this emotion of this warm blanket being constantly wrapped around me. I just knew it. And so I didn't have any fear The fear was that my daughter would not have a father.
You know, I think when we first started speaking, I mean, I even saw on your Skype profile you put happy next to your name. I've sensed that optimism that you brought up. Were you always an optimist? Or did this bring it out in you, this choice?
Well, you know, life dramatically alters when you get a normal heart, though. Mm-hmm. Because I think during that period of my life, I understood joy. And joy is different from happy. Joy is knowing everything's going to be okay. Joy is when you have this complete understanding that that love is really what matters the most, and the relationships that you have matter most. What you do for other people matter most. Because people were constantly helping me and my family. They were serving us. They were, you know, I mowing my lawn. They were shoveling my driveway. They were planting a garden that produced fruit. And so that was a really happy time for me. But then once you get this healthy, healthy heart, and you have to understand, leading up to that time, I only had half a heart. And so the level of oxygen and blood flow that went to my brain was not normal. When I got a normal heart, it was almost as though my body and my mind got this brand new computer system installed, and my brain had to catch up with my all the energy that was given to me. And so I went through a really, really dark period after my transplant. My marriage actually fell apart. You know, we talk about, there's this phrase in my culture, faith precedes the miracle. But there's not a lot of discussion about faith precedes the miracle.
Definitely not.
So for me, there was no warning label that said, if you get a heart, you're going to have these challenges. Because everyone receiving hearts at the time had already experienced normal hearts. I was getting a heart, and most people that have hearts are not even alive. I mean, they haven't survived. I was one of the few people from my state. So there's no study. There's nothing to say, okay, you're going to experience all these different emotions. So yeah, so it was a really difficult, dark time. But you know, you mentioned happy. I know what happy means, and happy is the goal. That is the joy. Ultimately, is what I think we all want to feel more than happy, because happy is just that's just a mood that you're in during the day. But joy is comfort. It's assurance. It's knowing that you've built a beautiful life because you have helped other people, and you have this pool of people who care about you.
I'm so glad you would make that distinction between the two, because, I mean, I think that is something we too easily, we replace one with the other. You know, we all seek for happiness when there's just such a different level when it's joy instead of the happiness. So I want to know then, what got you through? I mean, this was 7 years ago. So what got you through this time that you didn't expect, when you're finally, you know, on the mend and getting healthy, but still going through the darkest time of your life?
I think it's an ongoing journey to reclaim that. I think for a long time in my life, God almost in a way sheltered me in this beautiful bubble of joy and happiness. With this experience, it's almost as though he gave me this illness for a specific reason, and it's almost like he wrapped his arms all around me through the whole thing, and I was on fire, and then I get this new heart, and it's almost as like he kind of lets go a little while. And so it's almost like I'm this little kid trying to learn how to ride a bicycle again. And I know my father, you know, God, my father in heaven is there, and he's holding the back of the bike. But he's not as, I think he trusts me a little more to try to figure it out now. Mm-hmm. So it's this almost like this new relationship that I'm forming with my maker. And the reason I talk about God is because when you're born, and being told, hey, maybe you're not going to survive, you're obsessed with theology, because that gives more purpose and meaning to the suffering and everything. And so once you're healed and you have this miracle happen, it's almost as though you're trying to grasp what happened, why you survived, and why other people, because I had a lot of friends who did not make it. Mm-hmm. I went to a lot of funerals of parents who lost children. Mm-hmm. I think I got down in kind of like all the sorrow and sadness of it all, mm-hmm. Rather than embracing everything that was beautiful. Mm-hmm. We tend sometimes to dwell on negative things and things that aren't healthy, and we have to set boundaries for ourselves so that we can focus on things that are really positive. And one of the things that really happened when I was waiting for my heart is my younger brother, who was a 32-year-old man with beautiful wife who was pregnant and a 6-month-old and a 2-year-old child, he passed away. While I was waiting, he suffered from some mental illness, and mm-hmm. There was an episode that ended up taking his life. And so I didn't have time to grieve that. Mm-hmm. I had to focus on living. And then once I got the heart, it was as though all this grief mm-hmm. came into my life. And so I was a wreck. But the thing, to answer your question, I met my wife, who I married, you know, Tina, mm-hmm. who I'm married to now, and my ex-wife met this amazing man as well, and they're so good for each other. And yet my wife that I am married to now, she's incredible. She's so amazing and so solid and understands and knows me so well. And it takes you in this interesting journey where you kind of look back and, you know, it's almost like what happened, but at the same time, it's amazing what happened, this miraculous orchestrated miracle of how God recorrected everything and fixed everything, and gave everybody what they needed.
Just seems like a huge part of your journey has been learning, you know, acceptance too. Acceptance of the seasons of life, acceptance of the emotions that we deal with, the hard times we face, and acceptance eventually of this joy that you talked about. I don't know if that's something you can see as well, this acceptance being part of your journey.
Yeah, it's a big part. I think we have to learn to accept clearly our circumstances. I think when it comes right down to it, and you know this, everybody has something very challenging in their life. Mm-hmm. Some people have even more challenges. We face the consequences of our own actions, and we have to deal with the consequences of other people's actions. And so we're kind of maneuvering through this sea of, you know, big waves, and we're trying to stay afloat. And eventually we want to build a, you know, a good boat that's secure enough to get us up on top of these waves. And then eventually put up a sail so we can sail away from it all. Mm-hmm. But I think every single person is going through some unique thing, and I think the reason we all suffer is because it makes us stronger. Mm-hmm. And it's a strength, it's a gift in a way. Mm. Because I wouldn't know what I know and be able to accomplish what I accomplished had I not gone through certain things. I couldn't write the music I right, that's able to reach people had I not gone through hard things.
Paul, you're reframing so many things for me tonight, and just even thinking about suffering in that way as something, I don't know, to not shrug off or to despise or be angry about, but to see that it makes us stronger. I just love how you're reframing that. I think that applies to your music, too. I've heard you say in an interview that your music is often the product of pain, that it's arisen from very difficult times. So what is it about music that has given your suffering a purpose?
My music is a tool that people can use to help access spiritual feelings, to help access peace. I try to create music that enables people to just listen to whatever they need to reevaluate in their lives. I believe God speaks to us through music, certain, mm-hmm. well, not all music, but the certain music. I try to create music that allows God to tell people what they need. I've often said, if you listen close enough, you might hear God just whisper to you that everything's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so music for me conveys the darkest emotions of life, the sweetest emotions of life, and it's this universal language. I can reach somebody over in Egypt, where I ironically have a lot of fans listening to my Christian music, versus like Provo, Utah, where there's only a couple, you know, and it's because there's no words, and the music is what it is, and it just crosses these borders. So I feel like it's a tool that can be used basically for God to tell us what he wants us to know.
When did this love of music begin for you? Is it something that helped you as you were growing up and dealing with your physical challenges, or did it come later on in your life?
I used to, when I was 8 years old, I kept trying to think, how can I make some money? Because I want to go buy some cassette tapes.
Oh, really? Yeah.
I sold night crawlers. I raised hamsters, and I would sell the hamster, little baby hamsters, to the pet store, so I could go. I had a paper route. I would get all this money, and my dad would be like, gosh, you're spending it all on music. And I just absorbed it. Mm-hmm. And I remember buying my first record. It was a Duran Duran Rio. And I listened to it nonstop to the point where my dad was, and mom was like, I can hear the, this was before subwoofers. They're like, I can hear the beat through the floor. And I'm like, well, you got to dance or something. Yeah. They're trying to go to sleep. Mm-hmm. So I just loved music, but I didn't even really know how to play the piano. My sisters took piano lessons. I took piano lessons for 6 months. I just didn't like it.
Yeah.
A lot of kids, I mean, how many of us really like to sit down and practice?
Oh, yeah. You know, there's off the novelty of I actually taught piano for a few years before I had kids. So yeah, I've seen that transition often with kids. They're so excited and then they right away realize, wait, this isn't fun. This is hard.
I mean, it's very hard. Kudos to those that take, you know, that stick with lessons, or, mm-hmm. you know, that don't take the beatings from their parents. But but the kids, I mean, that take piano lessons, they do. It has been proven that if you take piano lessons or you play an instrument of some kind, that it's really healthy for the brain. Yeah. It stimulates the brain. But for me, my brain was dead. I just had no interest.
Well, I was shocked to learn that about you, though. That as a child, I mean, well, I was just shocked because, I mean, you're so gifted. So when did you pick up the piano again?
So, as a teenager, my friend, my good friend Dave, he could play Billy Joel on the piano, and I'd go to his house and I'd listen to him play, and I'd see him play Heart and Soul, and I'd be like, well, how do you do that? Mm-hmm. It's so amazing. And I would try to learn it. And our junior year, at the end of our junior year of high school, he was another sad thing. He was killed in a car accident. And
oh,
I was just devastated because, again, I was mm-hmm. like, what? Why? Here I am with this defective heart. Mm-hmm. And I'm still alive. And why does 1 minute this perfectly healthy person, you know, leave us, and here I am with all these medical problems and bills for my parents. What's going on? And it led me to the piano in my parents' living room. And I just sat there kind of weeping and trying to figure out life. And mm-hmm. I would sit and I'd play one note. I'd add a second note. And all of a sudden I felt this melody come through me, and I played the melody. And it was as though this awakening. It's like I pulled back the curtain to heaven, and I could feel this reassurance that everything is okay. And Dave fulfilled his purpose in life, and I've still got to fulfill mine. And from that day forward, I would sit at the piano like a kid who's addicted to video games, and I would play and practice and try to figure it out like it was a puzzle. And I was playing 3 hours a day, and 2 years later, I had a job in a restaurant playing the piano. Mm-hmm. It was a very sad happy birthday that I would usually play for people, but it was nonetheless, I was playing for tips. So
yeah. Well, so oh my goodness. So do you read music?
I learned to read music because I need it for communicating with other musicians, but uh-huh. today, I don't really rely on it. I now delegate that to transcribers and other musicians mm-hmm. who have that skill. So I work with people that do that. So I don't really use it as much.
One of the most talented musicians I grew up with in my hometown, her name is Corey Connors. She's incredible, but she doesn't read music. And I just think it's so incredible to see people. I mean, it does feel like a divine gift. And you've had to work really hard at it, though, too. So where does that come into play, this, you know, this word gift that you have, but also the hard work that goes into being a musician?
Corey, and I know Corey Connor. Her music is amazing. She's a great songwriter. Mm-hmm. Everybody is born with unique gifts. We don't always discover them right away. They come to us later. Mm-hmm. And if you look at the music industry today, most of the people that are actually making a living never had piano lessons. Paul McCartney is self-taught. Jimi Hendrix was self-taught. He didn't even know how to play. They both play the guitar backwards.
Oh my goodness. I didn't know that.
So most musicians are not very, you know, they don't really know. Hans Zimmer, who did Gladiator and these big films, he didn't really know how to do sheet music in the beginning, and he started hiring guys to do stuff for him because he could just play. Now mm-hmm. he knows and understands that because he learned the language.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I just think that some people are naturally gifted. I think it's an endowment from God to do certain incredible things. You know, we can turn on, you know, America's Got Talent and hear a young child sing like Sarah Brightman or Andre Bocelli. Mm-hmm. And it's like, where do they get this? And clearly you have to face the facts. I mean, it comes from God. Mm-hmm. So then it's to beautify the earth and make life better for all of us.
So as a professional musician, then, I mean, what I love about your story, though, is that your gifts, like you said, they came on, they became more part of your life later on. And I think that's really encouraging for people who might be struggling to know what their gifts are. And to just keep holding on and try new things, I think will be led to the ways that we have our gifts. But I wanted to speak about, this is your career, too. So what work ethic does it take to be a professional musician, and how are you able to stay so devoted to your craft?
It's interesting because a lot of, you know, people say, I know someone who plays the piano and they should do albums, and I know somebody who sang in church and they should do this and that. I think you have to make a conscious decision as a musician. If it's going to be a career, then you definitely need to kind of hang up music classes and start taking business classes in college. You have to take marketing because most of the people that are making a living doing music, are self-taught. It just kind of was given to them. There are people that learned it and disciplined themselves, but they understand the music business and they... And I fell in love with the business of music and the whole process of how it goes from the recording studio into the record label's hands, to the distributors, into the record stores. Because early on, when I got my first cassette and my first record, I would open it up from the plastic and I would smell it. And you could smell the fresh paint. And then I'd get so excited. I'd ride my bike I'm so fast to listen to that record. I just was so passionate about the whole process. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people focus too much, you know, that are going into the music industry, focus too much on making the song better. Mm-hmm. Instead of, and we know this because not every song on the radio is that great. But those people have worked so hard mm-hmm. and smart to get where they are today. They've met people, they've negotiated, they've learned everything they can about making deals. And so being a musician, you know, writing music is maybe 10% of what you do. The other 90% is a career. Mm-hmm. Of business meetings and everything that goes along with selling something.
Wow, that is so fascinating to see, you know, how those two come into play together. When you are creating, when you are working on your music specifically, what do you find helps you get in the right headspace that you need to be in order to develop this music?
It's definitely not always easy. Mm-hmm. So I try to set deadlines. Mm-hmm. If I have a deadline, I'm more likely to put the pressure on myself to get something out of me. I feel more like I'm kind of this transistor radio, and I'm relying a lot on divine help. I listen to a lot of music that inspires what I do. I don't always just sit down at the piano and come up with something. I have to be in the zone of you know, like an athlete that gets on a bike and starts cycling before he goes into the game. He gets all warmed up, and then he can go in and play, and it's amazing. I have to absorb myself in the style of music that I'm going to create. I listen to different composers, different artists, and then I try to transfer how I would interpret what they're doing. One example is I did a piece of music years ago called Life and Death, mm-hmm. and I heard the theme, the basic theme for this song on a TV show called Lost.
Oh, yes.
It was by Michael Giacchino. Michael Giacchino. And every time somebody passed away, they played this theme.
I know exactly
and so,
the theme.
Yeah. Da, na, 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 na. So I was obsessed with it, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, it's so beautiful. But it ends so, like the smoke monster and all that. They ended it just so
scary.
Horrible and scary. So I sat at the piano, and I just tried to work it out and interpreted it the way I did. And I took Michael Giacchino's 30-second theme and evolved it into this 5-minute piece.
Oh, I love that.
With full orchestra, which is now one of the biggest, my biggest streamed song on Pandora and Spotify. And it's amazing the number
of
people.
It's a million and a half.
There's a lot of people that have listened to Life and Death, mm-hmm. and people of all faiths, all cultures, mm-hmm. from a lot of different countries, over 150 countries.
Wow. So, I love that connection. That's what I love about music, is the connection that it can create for us. But for you, I mean, what does music mean to you?
Music, oh man. That's a hard question to ask a musician. Mm-hmm. But music basically is the language of the spirit. And it's either a good spirit or a bad spirit. And I think God wants to, it's one way God wants us to feel that we're all connected to each other. Because the languages, you know, were confounded, and everybody has these different backgrounds and different cultures, but we bring music to the table, and everybody can connect and relate to a good song, and that's the one thing that music does, is it's like the glue, mm-hmm. that binds us all together. You see this when you go to a concert. You know, there's a band who is so good in their ministry, and that's Coldplay. Mm-hmm. And U2, these guys, and it's a ministry. They are bringing people together and teaching that the most important thing in the world is love. And when you go to one of their shows, it's this big, beautiful thing that the music basically confirms that we're one big family. Mm-hmm. You know, we can do genealogy. I'm a big genealogy person. You can do genealogy, and eventually with genealogy we'll prove that we're all connected. You could put on a thumb drive eventually proof that everybody, if you trace our lineage back, we're one big family. We can have physical evidence through genealogy and through DNA research eventually that we're all one family. So I think music is the glue that can really connect and bind us and help us emotionally feel connected to everybody.
Thank you.
love your answer so much. And, you know, I've just been thinking about, as a musician, it's got to be hard to know when a piece is done. And, you know, I'm sure that as a musician, too, you've got a sense that no piece is ever perfect. I'm not sure if that's how it is for you. So what do you do to combat this drive to make a song perfect when sometimes that is unreachable? When do you know it's enough?
Well, I learned a long time ago that a piece of music is like a person. And a person is not perfect. Mm-hmm. They have character. They have raw things about them. And if you make a perfect song, then it's like a robot.
Yeah.
So the only person that, you know, you try to make a song as perfect as you can, because you want somebody to be as great as they can possibly become. So I compare it to people. People aren't perfect. Mm-hmm. Music's not perfect, but every person has an interesting story to tell. And there's depth and beauty to everybody, just like a song.
That's another thing you've reframed for me today, Paul. Before I ask you the last question, I would love if you can just let people know where they can find you and where is the best place for them to access your music.
You can access my music wherever you like to find it. It's everywhere. So iTunes, or stream it on Spotify or Pandora, Amazon. But my website is paulcardahl.com, and I have a newsletter there. I like to give away stuff. So if people sign on that, there's stuff we give away periodically, and it's a good way to follow what's going on and what's happening.
Great. So the last question, I ask this to each guest, and it's, what have you learned about yourself the past few years?
I have learned so much that the thing that I've learned is how much I need and love God and my wife and my kids, and people, I get to travel all over the world, and people are good and people are wonderful, and everybody, you know, has their own different story that they're living, different challenges. And no matter where I go, people are human behavior and everything. We're all connected. We're all the same. We have different backgrounds and beliefs and heritages, religions, but when it all comes down to it, you could have a conversation with anybody in the world and really relate. To them, because we're all connected, because we're one big family, which it's God's family. I think we're God's sons and his daughters, and he loves us, and he gives us he allows us to go through these challenges. He doesn't intervene. Some people go, well, why doesn't God help us? Well, I think he doesn't help us because he knows how much we're learning. And sometimes we just need to learn to get along, so he stays out of the playroom. You know, so there's a lot. I keep learning. I have a lot to learn, but you know, I've got a great companion, a great wife, and she's constantly educating me. And if I could be a little bit more like her, I'd be just fine.
Well, it seems you two definitely deserve each other, Paul. This has just been such a highlight for me. Thank you very much for being on.
You're welcome.
Can you see what I meant when I said this interview will change your life? Paul was so gracious to interview with me and to delay airing the interview and so much more. He is one classy man, and his music got my husband through his mission, and it's getting me through some other tough things I'm facing. And you can see his website, social media platforms, and music linked in my show notes. Go give Paul a follow, because he is not in this business for fame. And that is so clear in everything he does. Thank you again, Paul, for taking the time to be on the show. With the tone of this interview, I also delayed in thanking today's sponsor, so let's do that now. Monate, a hair company whose products are made to honor the hippies in us all. Monate products do not contain sulfates, parabens, harsh salt systems, phthalates, and more. But unlike all the other naturally based hair products that I've tried, Monate actually works. If you're looking for hair products that are scientifically proven to transform your damaged hair, elicit new growth, and add so much shine, health, and volume, these are for you. I have created my own video to share the difference Monate has made for my hair and why I am partnering with them. So you can see that linked in the show notes. If you're interested in them for yourself or a loved one, you can email me at packerprogress@gmail.com or check out my Monate Instagram account. And you can find that at the handle Monica Monate, and Monate is spelled M-O-N-A-T. I've had several interviews recorded the past few weeks that I am so thrilled to share with you. I think their voices are needed on this podcast, and I know that they are meant for you specifically. So I have some good things in store. This Friday is a bonus episode with Danielle Stepp, a young mother who recently faced cancer. Next Wednesday, I have Greg Karelitz, another happiness expert who has amazing things to share with you. I look forward to sharing those episodes, and until then, take care of yourself.